The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Senator Liz Krueger. You know what I love about Liz Krueger? She always tells you what she's thinking. She's not a BSer. She's a Democrat serving in New York's 28th District on the east side of Manhattan. Welcome back, Senator Krueger. How are you?
I'm good, Alan. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm excited about the coming year, even though the budget numbers are scary, but they've been scary before, and I ask people to elect me to do my best for them, so I try to embrace every responsibility, even the tough ones.
So, you know, you're real close to this now. Where are we going to get $6 billion?
Well, I think we have to tease through where the money is and isn't. So I am always greatly concerned that Governor Cuomo has a 2% cap on what he says we can increase growth in spending or hence revenue. Mm-hmm. But then he takes lots of the money off budget through various public authorities, and he continues to grow his economic development programs, which are mostly tax expenditures and reductions. So I really believe the whole public needs to understand much better that we have far more money than they think we do because we choose, or the governor actually chooses, to allow certain people not to have to pay taxes for certain things. And if we didn't have those expenditures, meaning we exempt people from paying certain taxes, we would have more money in the budget, even without raising taxes.
So who are you thinking of?
That would help address. Well, if you look through the tax expenditure budget, you'll find endless examples where we give reductions in taxes for certain kinds of corporations for specific deals that are taking place. One of my pet peeves at the moment is we give about $1.5 billion a year, and I think I'm underestimating, as incentives to the petroleum industry. Why would we be incentivizing people to use petroleum products? We're supposed to be getting out of fossil fuels at breakneck speed. So I think he's talking about increasing electric vehicles, and hooray, and we'll probably offer tax incentives for people to switch to electric vehicles. Great. But we still cap the growth in gasoline tax because of a very strange rule the Senate Republicans put in a few years ago when gas hit $2 a gallon. Well, we're all quite used to gas being significantly over $2 a gallon, but we cap how much we're allowed to collect in taxes when the prices are above $2 a gallon.
So why don't you
and
change that?
That just encourages use. Right, so we could do away with that and collect significantly more money. We could really evaluate this whole list, a master list of petroleum products that we're incentivizing. We could look at, and I believe we should, have a sunset date on every single tax expenditure. And they add up to like $30, $35 billion a year. So we should have a sunset date on each one, have to do a cost-benefit analysis before we continue them. And I believe that we would find billions and billions of dollars in revenue that should never have been coded as you don't have to pay it. Some of these refundable tax credits to corporations are, I think, the biggest problem. They owe us zero taxes the way they've set up their businesses under our tax law, But because we have things called refundable tax credits for certain categories, we end up sending them checks. Why are we sending them checks when they don't even owe us any taxes? Does that make sense to anyone? I don't think it does, but a huge amount of money go out that way.
So now that the Senate is run by the Democrats, why can't you just change this stuff? I get it. Republicans are Republicans. They have reasons for doing things, but they're not in control anymore. So why don't you just change them?
Well, because we can propose, but the way the Constitution is written and the courts have ruled, the governor has pretty much 95% of the power when it comes to the budget.
So why doesn't he want to do it?
You have to get him back on the radio and ask him these questions.
He's not coming
in. As I told you before, I will never attempt to speak on behalf of anyone else but myself. Certainly, I do not have a magic window into the governor's thought processes.
Is that a sort of obscure way of telling us that you think that the governor may not have a cogent way of looking at this stuff?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I would not presume how the governor gets his analysis done and how he prioritizes. What I can say is the way the courts have ruled the powers over the budget, the governor pretty much wins in 95% of the categories.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think he has too much power, yeah. But court cases have been won.
Yep.
Saying, yes, he does have that power.
I'm sorry. I mean, I was just trying to get you into trouble. Okay, so...
That's fine. I'm perfectly capable of getting into trouble. No problem.
You're terrific. Okay, so now, one revenue generator, as long as we're on the subject, is legalizing recreational use of marijuana, something you've worked on and supported. It seems like
yes.
This will be the year, especially because of the needed revenue, predictions around $500 million, to $1 billion. What do you think?
Well, I am a big supporter of ending prohibition, legalizing adult use, expanding access to medical marijuana for people who need it for illness, and expansion and regulation of the hemp CBD world. All of those are ready to go. They do need to get through the governor and the legislature. I am very optimistic based on the statements he made as recently as last week's State of the State, that there will be a robust package within his budget proposal coming out on Wednesday the 21st that lays out how we can implement these broad and complex laws that affect all of these products. And yes, there is opportunity for significant revenue from legalizing recreational marijuana. But I emphasize, it won't be overnight. It will take time. The revenue projections are for out years, not this year. And one of the things we have to be really careful about when legalizing marijuana is that we don't get too greedy about how much money we can make on it, because then people will stay in the illegal market.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't want are legal dispensaries with the criminal element setting up in the parking lot right outside saying, I've got a much better price for you. Come on down. So we have to be cautious and smart about building regulated legal markets. Now, of course, the pluses are we actually create real jobs in the legal universe for people who people will pay taxes. If you go and choose to buy marijuana, you will know that you are getting what you're buying, not some other stuff mixed in that can be harmful. You will know that you're not buying from a drug cartel who's also selling opioids out of the other side of their car. Additional pluses from other states that we're learning, when you make legal marijuana available and an expansive, robust medical marijuana program, you see a drop in people using opioids. You see a drop in opioid overdoses. So there's a double win from a drug and public health perspective.
Well, Liz Krueger, think about this for a second. I mean, I live in the great state of Massachusetts, right on the border.
Yeah.
The number of New York, we've talked about this, the number of New York license plates And our parking lots are huge.
Indeed.
And we're in Great Barrington. I think they've made a couple of million bucks for this little town just for what's going to the localities. Why is it taking so long? Why is the governor always talking about how he has to get together with Connecticut and New Jersey before he does it? Hey, they did it in Massachusetts. It's working fine. Why didn't this happen earlier? You know, this governor, I'm sorry to give a speech here, but this governor told me early on that he was opposed to legalization because he said it was a gateway drug. Now he's changed his mind since that time, but I don't know that I believe him.
Well, partly the answer is just what you said. He was opposed. I think his knowledge and his understanding of the issue has evolved over time. And I have nothing but kudos for people who do their homework and realize things that they thought they knew they might not have known. It's also true that Massachusetts, like almost every other state who has legalized, is a referendum state. Your legislature didn't give you legalized marijuana. You put it to the voters, and they said, yes,
yep,
we're fine with it. And in fact, Massachusetts referendum, when they did it, was almost word for word the bill I was carrying in the New York State Senate and couldn't move in New York. So folks in Massachusetts took a look at my bill and said, yeah, that works for us, and made it a referendum. We're not in New York a referendum vote. You can't bring it to the voters to vote on.
Well, shouldn't we?
So that's why. Well, the discussion of whether we should be a referendum state is going to take a lot more time than you would want to give me. I'm actually encouraged about referendum voting, but you can also see terrible things that have happened. California wiped out its education system because it took a referendum vote on education spending, and they went from some of the top schools and universities in the country to some of the lowest rated because of referendum. So sometimes the people, when you go directly to them, can make excellent rational decisions, and sometimes the people can actually get conned by somebody who comes along, decides to spend an enormous amount of money to impact the outcome of a referendum vote. And you can get really interesting experts to come on your show and give you the good, the bad, and the ugly.
We have Liz Krueger, and we will continue to. I want to talk to you because time is running out. It always does when I talk to you. The big fight right now is over bail reform and the issue of criminal versus civil rights. Cuomo says there's wiggle room, but Assembly Leader Carl Hastie and now Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins say they'll give the law time to take effect and stop fear-mongering. And the fear-mongering, of course, is that people are getting out of jail, going out and committing other crimes.
And what we have started to do is to track every single one of these press stories when they come out. And they're basically never what you think they are.
Really?
Just last night, this huge case in Long Island in Suffolk County of a hit-and-run DUI, and everyone was screaming that they were let go because of our new bail law. Then the Suffolk County DA's office came out last night saying, we just made a mistake. We could have held them.
But what, just for everybody who's listening.
Unintentional.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Yeah, just because everybody's listening, who are listening aren't fully aware of the whole thing. You have to do something violent in order to be held under bail. Otherwise, you go out and the judge doesn't have a right to make a distinction. Is that wrong?
That's an oversimplification because there are categories where the judge does have the right to make a distinction. And there are things in the history of people that give judges rights. And we made explicit in the law that the counties could use alternative monitoring, ankle bracelets, GPS tracking, other kinds of tracking. What people don't seem to understand is that under the Constitution, the purpose of bail is to ensure that somebody's going to show up for their court date.
Right.
It wasn't designed to keep people in jail because of a public safety question. That was always to be dealt with under the standards of law and judges and DAs and how they charge people. So really what our law, what we changed was back to what the Constitution said, that you should not be kept in jail because you're too poor for bail and bail is being used as the measure of whether or not you will return to court for your court hearings. And there have been many states that take the approach we do. We had a pilot in New York City to see whether people would actually come back even if they got out of jail without paying bail. And guess what? They come back for their court dates. That's not the problem.
All it takes is one, obviously.
There are reasons for limited numbers of people because of their danger to themselves or others being kept in jail until their court date. But we're talking about a history of tens of thousands of people who are sitting in jail for up to a year simply because they're poor.
Well, by the way, I agree with you. I think that's exactly right. But I want to ask you this. You've just won the Senate, the Democrats, for the first time. The Republicans think they see gold in this. And they're campaigning all over the place on the basis of this bail reform, which they are painting the way that you said is an oversimplification. And people are listening. So how do you handle that?
We're attempting to handle it by educating the public and the media to get the facts right, to understand what is and isn't impacted by our law, to, in fact, try to go when press stories come out saying, bum, 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 you know, Senate Dems let them out, to point out actually that's not the case at all. I mean, it's only January 16th. This went into effect 15 days ago. There's already stories out there that have been refuted time and again. Another case, and they're tragic cases. It was a man whose gun accidentally went off and shot his girlfriend and killed her. Okay, I'm not big on guns. You know that.
Yeah.
So, and we know that when people have guns, there are accidental shootings. This man, and the police have verified it, he's a decorated war vet. He's never had any incidents of crime or violence. And they actually do believe that the gun accidentally went off and his girlfriend died. And that's horrible. And that's a tragedy all around. But do you think that you're in danger if he's back on the streets for his trial? I don't think I'm in danger because of that. But it was written up, man shoots woman released. Now, come on. Everybody has to be smart, do their homework, analyze what the stories really are. And on this one, I'm going to say the press or some of the press is purposely feeding into the if it bleeds, it leads. And somehow something terrible has just happened.
Okay, now Liz Krueger.
That's simply not the story.
Liz Krueger, Governor Cuomo signed your Tenant Protection Act. What's in it?
Oh, my goodness. In 1 minute?
Okay, take two.
A compilation of 25 different bills that the Assembly and the Senate worked on and merged into one omnibus bill. But what it was an attempt to do was to take away the incentives for landlords to want to intentionally clear out rent-regulated tenants from their apartment buildings and skyjack the rent up. It was 25 years in the making. It put a limit on how much you could increase your rent based on some construction that you might be doing to your building. It put limits on not allowing you to jack up the rents by, right now it was, up, well, before our law, you could see rents go up 30-40% anytime there was a vacancy in the building, hence an enormous incentive for people to try to evict people and skyrocket their rents. You know, evictions have gone down over 20% in New York City just in the first few months this law has been in effect, because you don't no longer have a huge financial incentive to dump out your old tenants to get new ones. So it's already having an enormous impact in the areas of state that have rent regulation, which is the city of New York, parts of Nassau County, parts of Westchester County. We also gave the option to localities, if their local legislative bodies wanted to actually choose to create their own rent-regulated system, because there are now housing crises in many parts of the state of New York. And we don't think there are going to be that many localities who fit the criteria and vote to do this. But we were asked, please, to do this and give the options to places like Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, who who are also suffering from some of the exact same problems as New York City. Higher standards were put in place for tracking complaints and lawsuits by the state housing agency. Again, if you go on my website, LizKruger.com, or my Senate official website, you can find all kinds of materials explaining the bill, but that's the best I can do in 2 minutes.
You did very well. So we're talking to Senator Liz Krueger. What about the updated Fossil Fuel Divestment Act? Now, you have a friend, my friend too, Controller Tom DiNapoli.
Yes.
You don't agree with him on this, right?
No, I don't. And I find it fascinating because I think we actually do agree on the importance of not investing in fossil fuels and moving us to sustainable ASAP. And he's doing many things to get us there. But the one thing he won't do is to take a position of divesting pension funds from the worst fossil fuel companies, the companies that are disproportionately the biggest problem. And his argument is only the controller decides what we invest in. You don't have a say, legislature. And I get it, and he's actually doing an excellent job as controller, and I keep saying to him, fine, do this voluntarily. I'll stand up, applaud you, and I won't need the bill. Just do it voluntarily. And so he says, and I don't want to speak for him, but he says, but I'm moving more and more of our money into the kinds of clean energy you and I both want. And I go, yes, you are. Thank you very much. And yet we still have billions of dollars invested in some of the worst companies. And he says, well, I can try to change their behavior as a stockholder. And then we point out, no, you've tried that, and every time you've been rejected. You can't seem to change their behavior because you're a stockholder. But you could do what many countries around the world are now doing, many major investment funds around the world are doing, simply stopping investing in these companies. So
good.
We changed the bill.
Yeah.
Okay. We gave him more power. We gave him more opportunity to make the decision about which companies really are the bad ones. We set it up that clearly a company could come back on and be reinvested in if they met new standards. So we think we've created a alternative model for ourselves on divestment that he could be more comfortable with. I don't know whether he is or not. You have to ask him on, or ask us on.
We will. We will, of course, as we always, as we do. Okay, public financing, there was a commission. I'm not happy with the commission because they came up with a couple of appendages. The whole idea was to support electing people with public funds. New York City has it. New York State doesn't have it yet. But Governor Cuomo's guy on the commission, Mr. Israel, basically trying to kill the Working Families Party the way I'm looking at it. What do you think?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I'm not a big supporter of any of these kind of commissions where the legislature gives away our authority to independent commissions who somehow, when you look at the fine print, are really written up to, again, give the governor all the power over what happens. So the commission acted. The Senate Democrats appointees to the commission did not support the full package, did not support the what was done to the third parties. There's lawsuits going on, and some people think the lawsuits will shoot down the decision of the commission. I personally hope that is the storyline because while I'm proudly a Democrat, I don't think I really want to live in a country at the moment that would be a one-party country because I don't even think there's a real Republican Party anymore. That's a discussion for another day. But I don't think voters should be limited to one or two parties, and that's pretty much what we set up to do, although ironically, when you look at the commission requirements, the one third party that will survive is the Conservative Party.
Let me go, and I do only have 2 minutes here. You want more women. You want women on corporate boards, and you're trying to do something about that.
So the governor did sign at the very last minute of the bill I carried that requires a study of the makeup of corporate boards between men and women. California had gone further. They actually mandated a ratio of men to women on corporate boards. I didn't think I could get that through in the first year, so we went with the study bill to see what the current reality is. International results, fascinatingly, are countries or localities or just private businesses who purposely try to have a more diverse corporate makeup between men and women do better. They actually do better as companies. So I don't know what the magic of that is, but I think that's pretty relevant if you're looking at corporate structure and corporate outcomes.
Do you think there'll be a woman on a presidential ticket this year?
I think so. For the record, I'm an endorser of Elizabeth Warren, but whoever wins the Democratic Party, even if it's a small dog, I will be fighting very hard for in the general election because I don't see that we can survive as a nation if we don't take the White House back by somebody, including a small dog. But I think common sense, I don't know, would say if you're going to have a man at the top of the ticket, it's time to at least make sure you have a woman for vice president. You know, even though I just told you I have made one endorsement, it's not like anyone running for president calls me up and says, so what do you think? Who should I choose?
Liz Cougar, we are out of time.
I'm a big fan of Stacey Abrams, and I think it would be fascinating if she ended up as a vice presidential candidate for someone. Everybody take a look at Stacey Abrams.
We're out of time. Our guest has been New York State Senator Liz Cougar. Liz, as always, you're terrific. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.